So our reading this morning is from Dag Hammarskjöld. To have humility is to experience reality, not in relation to ourselves, but in its sacred independence. It is to see, judge, and act from the point of rest inside ourselves. Then, how much disappears in all that remains falls into place. It is the point of rest at the center of our being. We encounter a world where all things are at rest in the same way. Then a tree becomes a mystery, a cloud a revelation, each man or woman a cosmos of whose riches we can only catch glimpses. The life of simplicity is simple, but it opens us to a book in which we never got yet beyond the first syllable. This month, our congregation is contemplating the virtue of humility. When I first thought about humility, I imagined an earthworm poking its small pink head from the thick black garden soil. And since then, I have read much about humility and explored other images related to humility, but I keep coming back to this one. Our words, humus and humility, come from the Latin word humus, or ground. I like ground. I like earth. I like humus. I love to feel grounded. I love touching the earth, and I love smelling humus when it's all damp and wet in the spring. They are all indeed miracles to me. I belong to this earth. I am rooted in it, they remind me. And the earth is bountiful with life, and they all make my existence possible. Remarkably, scientists don't exactly understand humus. They know lots about it, of course, as do all good gardeners, and probably all the gardeners and farmers back for millennia and across nations. Humus is that fertile matter in topsoils. To create humus, dead plants and animals transform through the help of insects, fungi, bacteria, microorganisms, and other microbes into a complex, spongy, black, dark matter. This makes the nutrients from those once living plants and animals accessible to new life, to new plants. Humus doesn't have a particular form that we can define and categorize it. Is it organic? Is it mineral? It's something in between. However, whatever the category, humus is life-giving. It literally makes it possible for the earth to nurture new life by releasing nutrients and minerals and holding moisture so that plants can access it. It is both new, it's constantly reforming itself, and really old. Humus can last for millennia. I have always loved humus and the plants that grow in it, and earthworms particularly. I love turning the spring soil, and up comes a worm that then slides back down into the earth quick, quicker than you think a little worm could move. And I have personally contributed to humus the very best I can, the human way, through compost. As we used each spring, I would go out to the garden, and we raised animals, and so I would muck up the goat pens and the rabbit pens and the cow pens, and we would make all of that into big piles, which then were slimy and stinky, but then steamed and it condensed until it was this warm, brown, smelling good material. And then when I was in college, I was in an ecological agriculture program, and we had to do practicum at the organic farm. And there we learned the science of compost, like how much carbon you need, how much nitrogen you need, how you layer it, how much air it needs, how much water it needs. And we would make these very neat piles of, you know, carbon with nitrogen sources. And these piles would just steam and shrink in like 3 months compared to the 2 years it would take those to happen at home. And then we would layer that compost on the garden beds, and the worms and other microbes and would come up and eat it and bring it down into the soil, creating humus. The word human comes from the exact same word family as humility and humus. And that's not really surprising. In the Near Eastern traditions, religions, there are many stories where the God created humans out of earth. So there's a story of a Sumerian goddess who created a people, person-shaped form out of clay and then put it in her womb and birthed it. And then there's other stories where gods would throw stones over their shoulders and the stones would turn into people. And then, of course, there's the story in Genesis where Yahweh created Adam and Eve out of mud. So if you feel a really deep connection to the earth, these stories of human beings coming from earth, and that they've been linguistically linked, humans and humus, linguistically linked and culturally linked by our ancestors, probably feels nice and warm. I have that feeling. But what about the words humility and humiliation? What about those language cousins? Where do they fit in? As Reverend Leslie pointed out last week, humility is not one of the virtues that 21st century Americans spend a great deal of time thinking about. We are more inclined to consider self-actualizing, self-esteem, self-worth, self-love, and self-confidence as spiritual and psychological goals worth developing. Humility sounds just like the opposite, degrading of self, lowering of self. Why would we do that? It turns out that narcissism, and this might not surprise you, is increasing pretty dramatically in the United States. We are considered by many who study such things a narcissistic culture. Clinical narcissism is a personality disorder where people have grandiose ideas about how wonderful they are and their own importance and have no empathy for other people. Those with clinical narcissism suffer from intense self-loathing and shame, which is so terrible that they mask it over with grandiosity. And they really need other people to like them. And so they keep trying to get constant adoration by others. Narcissism is self-absorption and a desperate need for external validation. Narcissists are so concerned about what others see and react to them, how others see and react to them, that they can't actually see the other person as an actual person who has interests of their own and value. And so narcissists really struggle with having relationships with other people that are meaningful. So while researchers don't actually know clinical narcissism is on the rise, they do know that narcissistic traits, such as exaggerating one's self-worth and lack of empathy, most certainly are on the rise. And they don't really know why. I mean, the theories abound in different disciplines and different people who think about such things. I personally really resonate with the theories that focus on our culture. Consumerism and social media intensify individualism. Competition for resources and attention causes a desire to want us all to be special in some unique and important way. And it's really easy in this culture to become self-absorbed. What am I doing? How am I doing? Am I living up to my potential? Do I do well? Do I do well enough? Do I have enough? All these questions require intensive self-reflection and self-perfection. Our culture really values competition and superiority, and it has standards and norms about how you're supposed to be and what you're supposed to do, and it asks all of us to live those as perfectly as possible. It matters how you look. It matters what car you drive, the neighborhood you live in, the degrees you have, the jobs you have or had had, where you've traveled, how much you do, how well you do it, and what you know. People judge us on these things, and worse, we judge ourselves on these things. I actually just love the Winter Olympics because I love winter sports, and it's such a great amount of winter sports all at one time. And I love to watch the skiers and the snowboarders, those who do the flips and those that go downhill and those that endure for miles. And I love the ice skaters, those that race and those that dance and spin. And curling absolutely mesmerizes me. The medals, though, simply distress me. And all the talk about who's going to win the gold and how hard they've worked to win the gold and who's going to be on the podium and how disappointing it is when someone got the bronze when they really wanted the gold. It just feels like judgment about the worth of particular athletes. And for some athletes, it feels like for them, it's the ultimate judgment of their life commitment to a sport. Were they great, or did they come in fifth? One race, one performance out of thousands, and people are labeled forever gold or loser. How did this in the world become a loser? We are a culture that judges each other and ourselves. Our regular conversations are full of narratives where we pass judgment on ourselves and what we say. So many of us call ourselves bad or sinful for eating sugar or junk food. We put ourselves down if we have an exercise, or we make mistakes, even small mistakes. Most people are not narcissists, but it is easy to be self-absorbed in our culture and concerned about how we are doing and how we are seen. And this just doesn't feel that great. Most of us really genuinely need a spiritual and psychological practices that remind us that we are remarkable beings of the universe and absolutely lovable just as we are. We need to know that we are and feel worthy of respect. Self-humility? Lowering of the self? It sounds like humiliation. Humiliation is the feeling of being judged as not good enough, of being pushed down and made to feel unworthy. Humiliation is about being shamed. It is about being told that we are not enough, not worthy, not okay. And it is embarrassing and it's awful. We can be humiliated by strangers, by our bosses, by our coworkers, by our partners, our parents, our friends, and our children. But even worse than that is we can start up a whole litany in our head of self-judgment where we can just shame ourselves for things we did or things that happened. Our culture teaches us to feel shame for not measuring up to certain standards of behavior or of achievement. Shame and a need to hide that feeling is a major cause of clinical narcissism, and I suspect it plays a part in the rise of narcissistic traits as well. Shame is a feeling, according to shame researcher Brené Brown, that either drives us to want to gain control of others or pull away from intimacy, or to strive for approval. Shame destroys meaningful relationships because of our reaction to it. Narcissism and self-absorption destroy relationships. It is no wonder that Americans are some of the most loneliest, depressed people in the world. Humility. Humility is a way out of all of that. Humility is about as countercultural as you can get. It is the opposite of narcissism, and it is an antidote to shame. Humility is an attitude and practice that places us squarely into the web of life. It does not cut us out like Western culture does, making us independent individuals who must earn our belonging. And when we're humble, we are aware of our belonging in the greater web. William Beebe, a naturalist, used to tell this story about Teddy Roosevelt. They would get together and talk all evening. And then when they were done, Roosevelt would take them out into the yard, and they would look up at the sky, and they would see the spiral galaxy, which is in Andromeda. It is as large as the Milky Way, Teddy would say. It is one of 100 million galaxies. It consists of 100 billion suns, each larger than our sun. Then Roosevelt would grin and say, "Now I think we're small enough. Let's go to bed." Each of us is just one of 7 billion people who share this planet, and just one of uncountable numbers of individual beings who inhabit this earth. Angela J. Holmes said, "It is worth remembering that the entire population of the universe, with one trifling exception, is made up of others." At the same time, humility reminds us that each of us, humility reminds us also that each and every one of us is a child of the universe and of life. We are made of star stuff. Each of us is as lovely and wonderful and miraculous as a daffodil. We're a little more complicated than daffodils, certainly. We laugh, we cry, we have gifts, we have challenges, we have dreams and circumstances that thwart those dreams. We strive, or we don't strive. We are each just a small bit of the web of life, wonderful in our own particular way, but still just a small bit of the web of life, and that is humility. Humility reminds us the most important thing about us is that we belong to something greater than ourselves. When we are humble, our goal is not about ourselves. It is about our role in our relationships within this incredible web of life. Rick Warren, in The Purpose-Driven Life, wrote, "When we are humble, we don't think less of ourselves, we think of ourselves less." Humility is a way of being that makes love possible. Humility grounds love. Humility connects love. Humility is like humus. It is life-giving. Humility doesn't judge, not ourselves and not others. It never requires perfection or superiority. It doesn't have standards and norms that must be met by ourselves, by anyone else. Humility is a feeling of pleasure for what we do well, and acceptance for what we do not do well. And it is equal pleasure for what others do well, and acceptance for what they do not do well. Humility grounds us on the earth and allows us to reach out to everyone and say, "Who are you? How are you? What's your gig in the universe? What dance do you do?" It is the earthworm sticking its head above the soil and seeing the wonder of the world. Relationships flourish when the attitude between each two people is humility. Humility is the exact opposite of narcissism. Those with narcissism and narcissistic traits struggle to have meaningful relationships because their self-absorption makes it so difficult to see another person. Humble people are not self-absorbed, and they can reach out and discover other people and beings for who they are. Humility is also a way out of shame. Brené Brown says that shame resides in the dark, and that we can only release it when we share it with someone we trust. Whether we tell our moments of shame, when we tell our moments of shame, they lose their power to control us. When we are humble, we expect to make mistakes. And so we have more permission to tell those moments that felt shameful and bad and awful. And relationships are essential for the releasing of shame. And humility allows us to have the quality of relationships where we can share our deepest selves. Humility is a life-giving love, just like humus is a life-giving substance. When we are grounded in ourselves and open to others as they are, something happens, a transformation, connections, possibilities. Humus comes into being as once living matter transforms so that it can nourish new living matter. Humility comes into being when our focus on an independent self breaks down, so we can see ourselves as part of the web of life, so we can nourish relationships just as we nourish ourselves. Creating humility is like creating compost. It takes work. And it means layering spiritual practices together so they can work their own magical alchemy. It starts with the practice of remembering that we are all human. Our linguistic and cultural ancestors conceived of us as coming from the soil, not as perfect gods with special powers. We are imperfect with strengths and weaknesses. We make mistakes. We have great capacity for goodness and love, and we have great capacity to inflict pain on other people. And so is every other person that we meet. Mindfulness and self-compassion are essential ingredients for humility. Humility asks us to see ourselves as we really are, not as we want to be or we think we should be. Mindfulness helps us notice who we are and how we actually behave in the world and how that feels. Self-compassion allows us to give ourselves care and kindness when we make mistakes or when we get hurt. Self-compassion allows us to not run away or attack or seek approval when we feel shame or anger or hurt, but simply to offer ourselves that profound love that we all yearn for. The single greatest ingredient to humility is gratitude. When we notice every day all the things we have to be thankful for, we are reminded of everything we did not make that makes our lives possible, that makes the individual living of our lives possible. When we are grateful, we can see and experience the web of life that we belong to. Humility is not self-abasement. Humility is a reminder that we are not perfectible beings.
but we are relational beings. We belong to something greater than ourselves, and that is who we are, a part of something great. Humility is that earthworm so grounded in life-giving humus that she can poke her head out and experience the wonder that is our universe from a stillness to see the stillness in others. Humility puts our hearts in a holy place.
So we do have time for questions and discussions if people are interested.
In the terms of being part of the universe, what I know is that right after the Big Bang, there were a whole bunch of hydrogen and a few helium atoms. Everything else was built inside stars and spread out when they exploded. All the other atoms, the whole periodic table.
It's an amazing thing. And that's us. We are walking, talking stars.
Thanks very much for your thought-provoking talk this morning. You know, you were talking about how Western societies have become very narcissistic, but what preceded this narcissism was Calvinism, and some would say the Catholic sense of guilt as well. And they're really two sides of the same coin, that Eastern orientations don't seem to share as nearly as much. But it's fascinating how, you know, both strains of Western thought kind of emerged and put individuals at the center of judgment.
That is interesting.
Well, it's nice to be humble and good ideas. On the other hand, it seems to me that if you're going to actually do something, you've got to have some real sense of self-worth and purpose. And so I think what we have to do is to try to find a balance between those two things, or sort of we wind up very boring.
Oh, I think humility does not mean you do not have self-worth. I mean, you're still, you have a sort of realistic sense of yourself, which is as not a perfectible being. But yes, I mean, people are going to want to change things and do things. That's who we are, and we want to learn things. And I mean, that's just part of who we are. You're not trying to flatten out and just, you know, we're still who we are. It's just kind of putting yourself in a different position in the world instead of like self-absorbed individualist to versus connected into everyone else and having that be a more central orientation. But yes, of course, I think we need to have self-worth and self-love and self-care. It's all very important.
I was wondering, and we had a long conversation about this, but I was wondering if you could talk more about the learner's mind and humanity.
I'm going to talk about that completely in my next sermon.
Okay. A lot of good.
That is the next sermon. So we did have a long conversation about humility, which made some really great insights for me, which is all coming up next.
I love that the hymn that you chose to finish was Your Heart is in a Holy Place. Because to me, harmony and humility are very close together. And as we were singing, when you get to share a hymnal with Dave, you get harmony. It's just a really holy feeling, and I thank you for that connection.
Harmony is just singers who lose their way.
It's also a gift, and we appreciate the gift from others, which is being humble.
I kept thinking because of your earthworms. I read a story. Stephen Jay Gould talks about how after Darwin wrote, you know, On the Origin of Species and did a bunch of work related to that that was really well received and was this incredibly well-respected naturalist, towards the end of his life, he wrote a bunch of papers about earthworms. And everyone at the time thought this was ridiculous and made fun of him. And historically, everyone's gone, well, yeah, he went a little batty at the end, earthworms. But Stephen Jay Gould was saying, no, look, he cared about understanding the whole system and understanding how everything has a continuing cycle that is connected to everything else. And at the time, they didn't really understand hummus and the fact that earthworms are a significant part of how it works and how the nutrients process through it and how it's made. And so he was just trying to get at an important mystery that he cared about. He didn't care that everyone else thought that he was a cracked old man digging in the dirt for worms.
That's really interesting. So it was like the early ecology stuff. He also did a lot of work on emotions, I guess, which I just recently discovered. It's very interesting.
I'm working on being humble this morning because for about the third time, I forgot all about daylight saving. However, I heard enough, and thank you. Some thoughts came to mind. There's been studies done that one of the big reactions to a shame experience is the wish to get even. And I think there's a lot of shaming experiences that happened that result in that very thing. And I think that has to be a big part of a lot of the shooting that's been going on, especially with young people who somehow something breaks and they do those kind of things. So, I think that is something that really needs to be gotten at with kids, young people, who show signs of shame. And one of the signs would be crazy stuff, wanting to get even. But I think it's important.
Yeah, I agree. Junior high and high school, at least in my experience, was pretty awful in terms of being shamed.
I was thinking about the business of having to think well of yourself to accomplish something. And I think the places where I've actually managed to make some kind of contribution haven't been things that I've even chosen to do. There's things that I've had to do. You know, this just pulled at me, and I'm not there when I'm doing anything. There's only the subject. So I think that really, in a way, is sort of self-effacing.
Which is self-effacing?
Getting involved in something that you really care about. I think to an extent you disappear.
Right.
I just wanted to add a footnote to what Clive was saying about the impact of shaming messages to young males especially. Look up Samantha Bee's most recent program that aired this last Wednesday. She gives about a 5-minute riff that talks a lot and gives references about websites that are particularly aimed at young males, spreading the message that they are actually the victims of violence that is perpetrated by feminists who continually shame them. It is quite revealing about how focused and the kind of impact that this kind of message can have.
I've worked in social services for 100 years, and in domestic violence shelters, when you talk to someone, you know, we always think that victims of domestic violence need more self-esteem, you have to build them up. But one of the things that we see that sort of contributes to that is that they feel stupid. You know, they it's not so much a lack of self-esteem, it's that they think, I shouldn't have fallen for that. And they have empathy for other people, but they can't get past the, I'm smart, I should not have done that. And so what we have to tell them is, you are just a person, and you wouldn't think less of somebody else because they let it happen. You have to realize that you're not 100% of everything you should be. Deal with it and move on. Also in social services, I have a friend who runs a shelter, and she's done it for years, and she started having like major anxiety. And every time something would happen with any client, she would just start crying. I mean, she was like falling apart, and it was really... And in talking with her, I said, you know, your problem is you have a God complex. You've helped so many people that now you think you should be able to fix everything. And you have to stop feeling like that and just accept that you can't help everybody, that you just have to think about what you can do and do it. So it's like a weird humility, pride thing on either end.
And it's like, and I think that's the kind of the great thing about those myths that have human beings who come from the earth to say that you are not God, you are not perfect, you can't, you know, you're just, I mean, I think in some ways that's like to create humanness as that connection is somehow grounding and helpful. Like, yeah, I don't have it all. Can't. Sorry. Anyway. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you, Reverend Tracy, for another very provocative sermon.